This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. A recent report released by the Inspector General of the Justice Department indicated serious issues within the Indianapolis FBI field office and specifically with the former head of the department. The report alleges that there was serious mishandling in the sexual abuse allegations against former USA Gymnastics team doctor Larry Nassar. According to the Indy Star, the report found that senior officials in the FBI Indianapolis field office failed to respond to allegations of sexual abuse of athletes by Nassar with the urgency that the allegations required. With us now to understand the complexity of this case is Jennifer Drobak. She is the Samuel R. Rosen Professor of Law at the Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law. Welcome, Jennifer. What do we know about the situation that's unfolded with relation to the former head of the Indianapolis FBI? Is this a typical situation in law enforcement?
I can't say that it's typical, but when it does happen, it's very serious and it undermines not only the public's faith in the FBI, but as we can see from this case, many more children were abused by Dr. Nassar because the FBI failed to investigate this case responsibly.
Mm-hmm. And so they knew about all of this and it continued and he continued abusing while this was all just sitting.
Right. He continued to abuse. Estimates run to about 120 more young women and girls because the FBI failed to investigate this properly. And that has been documented now by, he not only failed to investigate, he actually lied to Department of Justice officials who were investigating the FBI's failures. Mm-hmm. So, and it also looks like he might have been engaged in self-dealing, trying to get a job with the U.S. Olympic Committee while these allegations were pending about this doctor that worked for the U.S. Olympic Committee.
I mean, this sounds like something out of a horror film. I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
You cannot. And something that hasn't been reported yet is that there is a law in Indiana which specifies that any adult that knows or suspects abuse of a child must report it to law enforcement officials. So Jay Abbott of the FBI was under mandate by Indiana state law to report his suspicions about allegations of abuse of minors to at least even Indiana state law enforcement that then would have referred this to the proper local authorities. And that didn't even happen as far as we know.
Right. And you bring up this important point. I was wondering, aren't we all mandated reporters in any kind of situation, especially involving children? And how is it that somebody in law enforcement was able to skirt that?
Right. We are all obligated under Indiana state law. And the fact that Jay Abbott didn't report is horrific. The fact that he was allowed simply to retire in 2018 is also amazing in a negative way. And we also really need to be seriously asking why it took the Department of Justice so long to release a report that began in 2018 as to why the FBI failed to fully investigate this.
Well, is there any sort of an ombudsman or something that overlooks all of these things to ensure compliance?
Well, the FBI, according to Director Ray, Chris Ray, the FBI is changing its procedures now, numerous years after the fact, to implement a status check, training to deal with child victims. But the fact that this is needed is really shocking. And the fact that there are no official investigations ongoing as to whether or not crimes were committed by top FBI officials, I think is also surprising. Certainly a couple of senators are calling for investigations and a special prosecutor to be appointed. And so Congress does have oversight here, and I think that should happen.
Well, for these things to be able to happen in the first place, is part of it the way, I don't even know, if the system is structured in a way where sexual abuse allegations are not treated seriously or they don't take priority?
Well, that's certainly the impression that most of us come away with. And this is not the first time that the FBI has failed to responsibly investigate sexual abuse allegations. All we need to do is go back to the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation process to see that there were allegations raised against the FBI at that time that Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's and other witness testimony and allegations against now Justice Brett Kavanaugh were not properly investigated by the FBI, that a tip hotline was not properly followed up by the FBI. So this raises serious concerns that would have occurred under then U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions and later U.S. Attorney General William Barr. And yes, I'm extremely concerned, and Americans need to demand more of our law enforcement. Now, that's not to say that there are not wonderful people in the FBI. And I do a shout out to former Special Agent Kenneth Lanning, who, you know, has a long career in supporting children, missing and exploited, sexually exploited children. So there are wonderful people in the FBI who are responsible and dedicated to their jobs. But we have a serious problem here.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Indiana's reputation will suffer because of this case?
Absolutely. No question. The law was not followed, neither Indiana state law nor FBI protocols. There are also FBI ethics questions here and possible allegations of self-dealing by Jay Abbott. So I think all of this needs to be properly, fully investigated by the lead officials who are responsible for oversight of the FBI to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Right. Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Well, Jennifer, in an ideal situation, what would happen to folks who are committing these kinds? I don't know. Can I say crimes? I don't know if you can until they're convicted, but for doing this kind of stuff.
Certainly they are alleged crimes, and Larry Nassar has been convicted of these crimes and is serving more than 100 years in prison. So yes, we can say that these are crimes because he has been, you know, since then convicted. But these convictions came in part because of revelations by the Indianapolis Star. So it was investigative reporting that caused the public outcry and the transparency needed to begin this justice process to work. And so I have to really, again, thank the investigative reporters that brought all of this to the light, because certainly the law enforcement officers who were in charge at the time, and even USA Gymnastics under Stephen Penny didn't. So, and he was also forced to resign because of this. So when the key officials do not properly execute their jobs, then we as the public have to insist on change, and we should hear. And I think there should be investigation as to criminal prosecutions of the responsible parties. Unfortunately, because so much time has passed, there may be statute of limitations issues. And one begins to wonder, and the USA gymnasts themselves wondered, and sent a letter in 2020 asking the FBI or asking the Department of Justice, excuse me, why they hadn't released their report regarding FBI failings. They were concerned at the time that statute of limitations would pass. And in fact, probably many of them have.
So are there any repercussions at all for those in positions of power, you know, heading up FBI offices to be held accountable for their interactions or the lack of actions, I should say?
Sure. Director Wray of the FBI is taking steps and has implemented changes for the future. And it's gratifying that those changes will be implemented in the future, and just horrifically sad that they didn't solve the problems in this case. Certainly, the Department of Justice should be looking at its internal procedures and even its investigation of all of this as to why it took 3 years for the report to be fully published. And I note that it came out just before this year's Olympics, and these young women were going to be competing on the international arena. But I also think that we as citizens need to step up and say, this is unacceptable in American law enforcement. And I think we should ask ourselves and our young people and encourage them to take jobs of responsibility in the FBI, in law enforcement. I'd love to see more women step up as agents. And as not only agents within law enforcement, but also within the U.S. Olympics, because there's certainly room for more women and perspectives of women and women allies in the U.S. Olympic Committee.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some diversity that needs to happen on a broader scale. We have about 30 seconds left here. What would you say for folks who are listening that are wondering what they themselves can do to be a positive solution?
Well, as we know, the law requires reporting of child abuse, and so people should take that responsibly. We also know that encouraging and supporting women and young girls matters and helps them to succeed. And so each one of us can do that in our respective lives.
Thank you so much for joining us. Jennifer Drobak is the Samuel R. Rosen Professor of Law at the Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law. Just ahead, what does the future of the internet look like? We'll hear from a researcher who keeps an eye on where things are headed. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soe. The internet can often feel like what's often referred to as the wild, wild west, a place where anything goes and there aren't many rules. But at least here in the United States, we don't really have to worry too much when it comes to censorship, right? But what about ownership? Who owns the internet and what is the future of this tool? Will it last forever or can it disappear? With us now to talk more about it is Nick Merrill, researcher at the UC Berkeley Center for Long-Term Cybersecurity. Welcome, Nick, to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Nick, I read your article titled Fight for Control Threatens to Destabilize and Fragment the Internet, and I found it fascinating for many reasons. The first one is that there is an entire field dedicated to studying this topic. So can you tell us a little bit about what you do and what your role is at UC Berkeley?
Sure. So my primary concern is making sure that the internet remains stable. And the stakes here are a lot higher than people think. So the scenario I like to paint is, imagine that you go to the store and your credit card doesn't work. And also no one's credit card is working. And in fact, you know, you try to access some news site to figure out why no one's credit card is working and you can't access the news either. This is a scenario that's likely to induce really widespread panic. I mean, we're talking about, you know, really serious kind of panic buying, rush on ATMs, rush on banks. So, you know, this is a scenario that I think people don't realize how likely this is. And it could play out here in the United States. It could play out, certainly it is likely, I would say, to play out worldwide, especially in the global South. And we want to keep an eye on these kinds of risks to the internet stability, because it's about so much more than that. It's really about kind of social stability, you know, in some cases, preventing wide-scale civil unrest, things like that.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And what compelled you to write this piece?
You know, I have been following kind of threats to the internet for a really long time. And I started thinking about internet fragmentation, which is this idea that the internet is becoming increasingly different in different places, especially in, you know, places like Russia, China, Iran are often cited as examples of places where the internet is kind of coming under increasing national control, that borders are going up online, that this, you know, what is assumed to be an international infrastructure is becoming increasingly siloed. And we began researching this in 2019, kind of measuring this problem. Is it getting better or worse? And somewhere along the line, it started to dawn on me that fragmentation, although it's a serious problem, is really only one scenario for the internet, and a more likely, and in fact, a more catastrophic scenario, is one in which the internet becomes massively unreliable worldwide or even in just in local areas. What we ended up looking at basically, or what I call structural risks to the internet, these are things, weak points, where, you know, a little bit of bad luck, maybe a confluence of bad factors, can cause cascading outages that last days, you know, months even in certain places, and maybe go on and off and basically, you know, break the internet's, what I would call its reliability.
I'm just thinking right now about times when I would log on to a service and it would be down, and then I go to like Down Detector or something and try to figure out, and everyone's like, yeah, it's not working for me. Is that similar to what you're talking about when it becomes unreliable?
Sure. So, you know, I think we've all been in a situation where a service has gone down and we can't access that service, right? So typically this happens to maybe one service we're trying to use at a time. And, you know, this is acceptable. Kind of we understand that this happens. What we're thinking about is more a service that happens, a service that goes down that causes a bunch of other services to go down with it. So there are these infrastructure providers on the internet. One example are content delivery networks. Most people don't even know what these things are. But a company like Cloudflare, for example, has its tendrils in all these different parts of the internet. And if Cloudflare, for example, faces an outage, a lot of the internet goes down. And we actually saw this with a CDN recently called Fastly. It took down a tremendous, like the UK government's website, CNN, you know, Reddit went down, Financial Times went down, tremendous portions of the web went down because of this outage in Fastly. So now consider this. Fastly has only 5% of the market, and Cloudflare has more like 80% of this market. So you can start to see that there are these centralized weak points on the internet that can cause these, what we call cascading failures. And that would be a situation where, okay, not only is the site you're trying to access down, everything is down. You can't access anything on the internet, or the things you can access are scattershot and random.
Wow. And is any of this fixable in the way that maybe somebody shouldn't have 80% control of all the sort of real estate out there?
That's certainly a sensible suggestion. You know, I think that what we're trying to look at here is how do we solve this in a practical way that minimizes disruption? We obviously want to solve these, but we don't want the solution to be something that causes disruption in and of itself as we transition. Nor do we want to propose a solution that is only taken up by some portion of the internet, which itself causes a kind of fragmentation. So I think that our role really is to map or create an atlas. Our project is called the Internet Atlas. To create an atlas of where these weak points are in a way that, you know, we can kind of help the global community solve them in a way that makes sense, to optimize for the kind of internet that we globally want to see and want to live in. You know, one of the kind of key aspects of today's internet is that the US really has a tremendous amount of control over it. You know, and I think we are all familiar with tech companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon. People are less familiar with some other tech companies like Cloudflare. And then there are some nonprofit organizations like ICANN, that are, you know, have for historical and other reasons, a lot of basis in the United States. And this allows, for example, the US to do things like take down websites that have a .com domain or a .net domain. These .net, .com, these are actually administered by US-based organizations. And something we saw recently, the US took down an Iranian news site, basically seized its .net domain. And it did so in the name of kind of combating disinformation. But I do think we have to ask, what kind of internet is this where one government can take down content for the entire world? You know, that's even a step above kind of national censorship. These are the kinds of questions we ask. And then from those measurements and from that atlas, we can start to build possible solutions.
That is so fascinating, just to think about so many of these different elements that, that come into play. Well, when it comes to, you're talking about this sort of control, I mean, who really is in control, and is it something that we should worry about?
The answer is that no one is really in control. There is no one party that runs the internet. There is kind of a mechanism by which, you know, some number of people have some keys that control something that's very fundamental to the internet. But really, no one party runs the internet. The problem is that one party, and you know, specifically the U.S. federal government, has all the tools it needs to pretty much take over the internet as we understand it, if they wanted to. You know, they have this kind of basis in court orders and using court orders to seize domain names. If that mechanism were to expand to include other kinds of service providers, for example, content delivery networks, search engines, you could really envision a situation in which we have an internet that is global, but globally censored. This is kind of the antithesis of the internet fragmentation outcome. It's more an internet that is completely hegemonic. And yes, you know, this really is something that keeps me up at night more than fragmentation, I would say. Really, when we think about protecting the internet, that's one of the primary things we want to protect it against. You know, it's not to say that this is going to happen tomorrow, but structurally, it could happen tomorrow. And we really need to make kind of technical safeguards to make sure that there is meaningful global governance over the internet.
That's interesting, because I've always imagined that the internet is this free-for-all place, and these tech companies keep trying to keep it, you know, anybody can say whatever they want. But then to know that it can be globally censored is very interesting.
Well, the tech companies have kind of, you know, run the show for a while. And there has been this, for lack of a better word, laissez-faire relationship between tech companies and the U.S. government. I think we all understand implicitly that that cozy relationship is coming to an end. There's increased scrutiny over tech companies by the U.S. government, over things like antitrust. And of course, to a degree, I think the popular opinion is that this is justified. There are antitrust concerns with companies like Amazon, price fixing, and other things like this. The downside, and I think the downside that people don't appreciate, is that this increased scrutiny, we don't know exactly what form it's going to take. And it's extremely possible, for example, that this increased scrutiny will take the form of, you know, more U.S. government participation, let's say, generously, over the shape and structure of the internet itself. Could this turn into a U.S. censorship globally scenario? I would say, from a technical standpoint, absolutely.
Wow, this is a lot to think about. You know, one thing that I came across in your article was this about the infrastructure. And there's cables that deliver internet under the sea. Now, was I reading that correctly, or is this something abstract?
Correct. 95% of all internet traffic travels through cables underneath the ocean.
And so with that, you mentioned there's this threat to cut off access to, I think it was like people in places like Tonga. How likely is it that somebody could come and just cut these cables?
Well, you know, the likelihood has to do with kind of the political motivations. But let's say an actor like China wanted to come in and cause some disruption, or even just, you know, make a power play in the South Pacific. It would be a really easy thing for them to do. And in fact, this cable to Tonga has gone down before and really kind of severed internet access, such that Tonga had to rely on the satellite backlink, and it doesn't work particularly well and doesn't scale particularly well. So, you know, when we think about cables, those are the kinds of things we think about. And undersea cables are incredibly important conduits. You know, the South Pacific is a great example because that's the only way really they can get a meaningful connection to the broader internet. And when we think about the internet, we look at how all of these cables connect to each other. Who has a lot of cable connections and who has very few? So, for example, the U.S. connects so far, is a really important connector between Asia and Europe. We sit kind of in the middle and the cables kind of run through the U.S., a lot of them anyway. So when you think about, you know, for example, cutting off the U.S.'s internet access, this is not a very likely scenario. But there are other countries, for example, Ukraine, where they have more limited connectivity. And in particular, Eastern Ukraine, there's some great study about this from some colleagues of mine in France, which I'm happy to kind of, you know, I think you could probably find it pretty easily on my blog, where they were looking at kind of the relationship between the internet in Eastern Ukraine and kind of Russian state control over, you know, the kinds of basically messages that can be sent around on that internet. These are the kind of infrastructural details that can cause really, really big ruptures in the global internet. I mean, we're talking about, you know, Ukraine not being able to access anything. This is really, really serious tool in a warfare scenario. And, you know, something you would want to keep an eye on if you want to have a robust internet connection globally.
Do you think any of this stuff is because we've become too reliable on the internet? You know, I feel like we've put all our eggs in one basket and everything is online. So if something were to happen, we're kind of in a bit of a pinch. Is there any other solution to sort of, I don't even know, have something alternative to the internet?
Well, it's certainly true that we've become extremely reliant on the internet. The design of the internet, though, is that we don't have to trust it because it's so decentralized. And the story we've been told, the story that's always told about the internet, is that from an infrastructural standpoint, it's massively distributed. And really, there is no one internet. What we have instead are these kind of distributed computing resources that are networked together kind of, you know, haphazardly in some ways, so that if parts go down, if certain things go down, we can always route around those failures. That's the story we're told about the internet. It routes around failures. So the problem isn't our reliance on the internet per se. It's the fact that the internet has become so centralized that we can no longer route around those failures. That narrative no longer holds. That is really the problem we're trying to solve here. I'm not a Luddite, and I don't, you know, want to tell people to go get offline or anything like that. Quite the opposite. What we need is to kind of restore the internet back to this infrastructure that really is meaningfully decentralized.
Yeah, I see your point there. Well, is there any worry, though, about bad actors exploiting these weak points that you found?
Yes, I have many, many concerns about that. One in particular that might be interesting to listeners. Russia has kind of raised some eyebrows recently for saying that they are doing these drills where they disconnect themselves from the global internet. The idea is that they cut off themselves from the rest of the world, and the internet domestically seems to work. Anyone in Russia can still contact anyone in Russia, but they can't contact anyone outside of Russia and vice versa. So why would they want to do that, right? Well, kind of one concept I've had that I haven't heard a lot of people talk about is that if Russia did want to attack some weak point in the global internet, it would be a problem because they would face blowback. The internet would break for them too, unless they can disconnect themselves, right? Oh. So my suspicion here is that their interest in disconnecting themselves is kind of married to a possible strategy where they break the internet for the entire world, but it continues to work for them. That's a really serious concern. And, you know, I think probably good enough reason to start thinking about how can we make the internet more robust.
Well, could the U.S. do the same strategy and disconnect itself to preempt Russia?
You know, it certainly could. I think that, you know, probably a lot of Americans wouldn't even notice that they weren't connected to the global internet because we have such a robust infrastructure in the United States. Whether that's the kind of internet we want to see, that's a normative question. And, you know, probably the global community would not want to see the internet fragment into, again, these nationalized silos that are, you know, domestically connected but have limited connectivity globally. Again, you know, it sounds like a good idea, but if we do have these, let's say, few but well-defined or well-protected pathways internationally, it sounds good, but again, produces fragility because it makes it more difficult to route around failures.
Well, what about anything that you're seeing now? Is there, aside from what you mentioned with Russia, is there anything that you're seeing now of concern?
I mean, yes, I see things that concern me every day. I think my entire day is filled with things that basically cause me severe concern. You know, but I would say at the same time, there are things that fill me with hope. There are a lot of people who are legitimately interested in core internet infrastructure in a way that, you know, I really haven't seen lately. And part of my job, I think, is to stimulate interest in this thing that we use every day that people really don't understand, and showing kind of how amazing this thing and how amazing this vision of a truly global system that can connect every computer in the world in a shared way is. It really is an amazing thing. And I think if provoking kind of a sense of wonder in that in itself stimulates interest to make that thing stronger and more robust. You know, I think that the idea of a national telco network isn't a compelling vision for the internet, the way a really, you know, global decentralized system where anyone can talk to anyone is a really compelling vision. And restoring that vision, restoring kind of wonder in that vision is something really important that we can do.
Well, the internet is definitely an amazing tool. And I, you know, as someone who grew up watching it grow, it's definitely been a great privilege to be able to use. Any advice you have for our listeners who want to make sure that nothing bad happens?
Hang tight, you know, keep some cash on hand. No, seriously, I think that there isn't much that kind of everyday people can do about this, but I do recommend people read up a little bit about how the internet works. If nothing else, look into content delivery networks to understand how central and really how important the service that they provide is, but also how centralized they are and how that centralization provokes stability. Certainly, you can follow my blog and see what worries me, you know, pretty regularly. but you know, other than staying informed, I would say, you know, kind of just, yeah, stay informed. That's the best thing to do. And remember how amazing the internet is. And as much as tech companies have, in some sense, kind of ruined it, you know, it really is still has this amazing potential to connect people. And remember, there are 3.4 billion people who are just now getting online. We can make the internet good for them.
Well, thank you so much, Nick Merrill, researcher at the UC Berkeley Center for Long-Term Cybersecurity. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We've discussed a lot on this show about how the pandemic has affected many facets of our lives. And many of us have heard about nursing homes being ravaged by COVID-19 in some areas. But what is the effect of the pandemic on nursing homes and nursing home residents? We might hear numbers, but beyond that, these are people with names and faces and families. And with us now to talk about the first of its kind study are Dr. Kathleen Unroe, Regent Street Research Scientist and IU School of Medicine Associate Professor of Medicine, and Dr. Aileen Kerr, Indiana University School of Medicine Assistant Professor of Clinical Medicine. Thank you both for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you. Very excited to be here.
Well, I'll start with you, Dr. Unroe. Can you tell us about the study you're doing and how it fits into finding out what's been happening to nursing home residents during the pandemic?
Absolutely. So the authors on this study, we're geriatricians, so we provide clinical care for older adults. So Drs. Carnahan, Lieb, and Wagley worked with us, as well as IU School of Medicine medical student Lauren Albert on this paper. And as you said, there has been a lot of discussion about the numbers, the mortality numbers of nursing home residents. We wanted to do a deeper dive into the clinical experience of symptoms. Once someone is diagnosed with COVID-19 in a nursing home, what did that look like? The data that we share is early on in the pandemic. Certainly, we live in a different world now on a number of fronts, especially since we have vaccinations. But we felt it was important to explore what the symptom experience looks like. And, you know, Ellen can talk about this as well. You know, we were doing a lot of communication within facilities with families and with residents. And I think we all, as clinical providers, remember how frustrating it was to not be able to tell people what to expect, just not to have the knowledge about this disease. And that's not true now. We have unfortunately, we have a lot of experience with this disease. This paper is an attempt to codify some of that knowledge and to arm us moving forward and being able to describe it.
Well, Dr. Kerr, what is your role in this study?
Yeah, so I was involved in some of the conception and data review and then eventual writing of the paper. But like Kathleen said, I am a clinical geriatrician, and the majority of my time is spent on the front lines in the nursing home, caring for these residents during the early pandemic and now, and then communicating with families. I thought it was really helpful as a clinician to categorize the possible trajectories that our residents are going to face. And that way I can have a data-driven discussion with the resident and their family members so we can make good decisions for these loved ones and these residents. So this paper reflects my clinical experience, but then it also couples it with the data. So really just solidifying the conversation that I can have with families.
Well, Dr. Unruh, what prompted you to go down this route and look into this? Was there a moment that made you think this is something important to document and to look into?
I've had a number of conversations with, you know, with residents throughout the pandemic. And, you know, one thing I hear people say is that, you know, that no one can really understand what it's been like to be on the inside of a nursing home. The visitor restrictions, you know, that the federal and government imposed for, you know, public health infection control reasons really prevented families and other people in the community from coming into facilities. And so there just hasn't been, you know, a good line of sight into the day-to-day experience of nursing home residents during the pandemic. And, you know, and in point of this paper, you know, who were diagnosed and suffered from and with this condition. And so that was the motivation to describe and categorize more of these symptoms. I also have a very strong interest in palliative care, which is focused on managing symptoms. So again, wanted to document that, you know, most people, you know, even in a nursing home with all the comorbidities nursing home residents have, survive COVID-19 infection. But, you know, there's a lot of complications that can occur, and there's a lot of suffering that can occur when someone is acutely ill. That's why we felt it was important to describe the symptoms.
Well, you're mentioning that a lot of the nursing home residents that contracted end up surviving. I think that's something I haven't heard before. And I don't know if there's something you want to elaborate more on that. Is that a misconception that we have when we hear about this?
The mortality rate for COVID-19 is absolutely higher in this population, you know, than in the general public or even in older adults, not in nursing homes, for all kinds of reasons that make sense. The reason someone is receiving care in the nursing home is because they have serious medical illnesses, functional impairments, cognitive impairments. So it is a higher risk group. But still, you know, I've seen some different numbers, but, you know, 80%, 70 to, you know, 80% of people who get this disease will survive. And though they may experience prolonged, you know, immobility, they're not feeling well, they're not getting around. And that takes a lot of, you know, rehab, of physical therapy, occupational therapy to regain function. Also, it's scary to be in isolation, particularly for someone with cognitive impairment who cannot understand what's going on or who has delirium and, you know, trouble processing what's going on while they're sick. And so there's a lot of, you know, emotional and psychological support that needs to happen as well. And so, you know, highlighting the symptoms that they experience and the length of the symptoms is also part of our trying to think through what kind of resources we need to support people after COVID-19 infection.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Kerr, are there any sort of misconceptions you've come across when it comes to the public's perception of nursing home residents and how they've been dealing with the pandemic?
Yeah, so I think one thing that we would love to highlight is the long-term care healthcare worker, how adaptable they've been when they are adapting to all these new processes and protocols. And they are doing it to provide compassion, and they're getting to the root of their job, which is nurturing, comforting. So I think that would be what I would highlight, and is a misconception of these residents not being cared for, because working in this setting, I witness it every day. I witness staff going above and beyond and sacrificing in order to connect loved ones with families, to provide their favorite hobbies, and to do activities in a safe manner with social distancing and masking. So I would definitely highlight all that these healthcare workers have done.
Yeah, I think that our healthcare workers are often overlooked when we just hear these big headlines of outbreaks in nursing homes, and we don't realize that there's people there that are working hard, that are doing what they can.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Dr. Unruh, was there anything you uncovered during this study that maybe will change the way you do things moving forward?
Well, you know, one thing we talk about in geriatrics is older adults, especially much older adults who have other medical problems, it can be very tricky because to diagnose any type of condition because they may present differently. But actually, fever was the most common symptom that we found. So fever and shortness of breath were the most common symptoms. And so that is consistent with, you know, how this looks in the broader population. So that that was really an interesting finding, I thought.
And what about you, Dr. Kerr?
I agree. I also thought we picked up on fatigue, anorexia, low appetite, falls. And so these would categorize as a geriatric syndrome, something more specific to the geriatric population. So they are likely to have these things, and that can trigger thinking about testing for COVID-19 and putting that on your list of possible diagnoses. So I think that was a great helpful finding. And I just think that also detailing that these residents were experiencing symptoms for 3 weeks, this is very intensive care, intensive bedside care, and a lot of nutritional hands-on support. So I think that was a really helpful finding as we think about staffing resources to help our residents through this COVID-19 outbreak.
And what was it like? Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm glad that you highlighted the anorexia, Ellen, because, you know, keeping people hydrated and eating was one of the biggest challenges in caring for this population. And I haven't seen that in other descriptions of people in the hospital with COVID-19. Like you mentioned, Ellen, you know, we supported people for some weeks with this condition, and it takes a lot of, you know, time intensive staff care to be at the bedside, giving people sips of water, you know, just trying to keep people hydrated. A lot more IV fluids than we normally use in long-term care. So that is a big part of supporting these residents through the virus.
And when you look back to when the pandemic first started until now, were there some things that you didn't know that now you know?
So absolutely. Early pandemic, we would place a resident in isolation who was COVID-19 positive. And then right at that point, CDC was requiring 2 negative tests in order for them to come out of isolation and go back to their room and start the recovery process with physical therapy. So with this 2 negative test, we found that we were keeping residents in isolation much longer, and we were very grateful to get the new guidance that it was going to be 10 days from that positive test or onset of symptoms. And then we were able to move residents back into their environment and really rehab them physically with their nutrition and emotionally. So I think that would be what I would highlight.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Unruh, nursing home residents and the elderly often cited as high risk for COVID-19. Now that we know there's this risk, is there more preparation being done to protect these vulnerable populations?
Oh, of course. You know, that's what I was going to say. It's not just what we know, it's what we have now. We have abundant access to testing and to PPE in a way that we did not have a year and a half ago. And we have vaccinations. Those have been such a game changer in our setting. And nursing home resident uptake of vaccines is very high across the country, you know, reflecting, I believe, certainly the experience of the last year and a half, but also this, you know, hope and desire that getting vaccinated will allow them to reconnect with family in a safe way, reconnect with the community. So yeah, we're in a different place. We have more tools, but vaccinations being the critical one.
Mm-hmm. And what about with these variants now that are making headlines? Is that of concern?
So I would say, yeah, it's definitely a concern. It is of most concern for our unvaccinated staff, because we are concerned about it coming into the facility via unvaccinated staff. Now, even we're still learning about vaccinated residents and vaccinated staff and the risk of transmission of the Delta variant. But I think it is a possibility. It is a risk. And we as a nursing home need to prepare. And, you know, this paper outlines kind of the intensive needs that, you know, these patients require. So, you know, we need to prepare. And I also think that, you know, vaccination works. If, you know, our communities and our staff are vaccinated, we have a significantly greater chance to keep COVID-19 out of our facility. And that's really going to impact resident lives.
And on the note of vaccination, I just read something today that some studies out of Israel are showing that older adults and those who are compromised should receive a third dose or a booster. Have you heard anything about that?
I'm certainly aware that it's an area of active investigation. And I think that one thing that that will enable that is, so many new systems have had to be built for widespread dissemination of vaccinations, communication about vaccinations. And so I think it's absolutely expected that there will need to be a booster or need to be another, another series. You know, is this going to be an annual need that we have? But those systems that we've built on the public health side and within the nursing home industry will all be leveraged to be able to do that. And, you know, Ellen, we were talking about like how the nursing home can prepare, how we can prepare within the facility and how the industry can prepare. But it absolutely is a broader community responsibility. One thing we're learning with the Delta variant is that the potential for transmission of the virus among even people who are vaccinated and the risk there. And so even a vaccinated healthcare worker is still living her life in line at Target or Walmart, or Kroger. And if the broader community is not also not getting vaccinated and not, following precautions, like that still presents a risk to people in nursing homes. So it's really all of our responsibility to protect everyone who's higher risk in our community. Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's something, for all our listeners who are tuning in and want to know what they can do, they can get vaccinated.
Absolutely. Great point. Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Well, what will the data, Dr. Kerr, from this study or this paper be used for? Is it going to push for any changes?
I think the greatest impact to use this data is to prepare. And so that means gathering your testing supplies and your process. And that also means getting the staffing that you need, the PPE you need. And then this is allowing us to really anticipate the needs of our residents and to care for them in place, because that is their goals of care. And I also think that one of the big impacts is when we communicate with residents and family, say, these are the possibilities of what we can expect. And knowing this information, this data that we, systematically collected and looked at, knowing this information, kind of what would you choose? And I think that's how we can take this, what we learned from this paper, to the bedside.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you both so much for your time. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Dr. Kathleen Unroe-Regenstrief, Research Scientist and IU School of Medicine Associate Professor of Medicine, and Dr. Ellen Kerr, Indiana University School of Medicine Assistant Professor of Clinical Medicine. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for the Friday recap. As always, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. And you can also leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Or you can reach out to us on our app. It's called All in Vox Pop. You can find it anywhere you get your apps. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.